across the state of Wisconsin. Daybreak with Brian and Jamie is back.
It's 8:06 right now. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. If you are listening in Wausau on WXCO or in Hayward on WBZH or in Eau Claire on 93.5 The Tap, we're glad that you decided to join us. My name is Jamie Martinson.
And I'm Brian Noonan. Don't forget you can get our podcast if you go to Spotify and look up Daybreak with Brian and Jamie. You can also get the free Civic Media app and check out our new social media pages on Facebook and Instagram, Daybreak with Brian and Jamie. All right, now that we've done those plugs, it's time for some stuff you need to know.
It's a wake-up call in more ways than one. Time for some you need to know.
Well, Brian, I don't know if you know this, but Pete Hegseth was at a microphone this morning. He was giving a live briefing on the Middle Eastern conflict. And according to the Department of Defense, Secretary of Department of Defense, Iran still has the intent to develop nuclear weapons despite the earlier strikes. These are some of the comments that he made this morning. U.S. and Israeli forces launched new strikes after intelligence showed Iran's timeline remains about 9 to 12 months. And this is all according to Hegseth and Dan Kane just this morning. Hegseth says prior attacks set back but did not eliminate Iran's nuclear program, also going all the way back to June when the initial attack from this administration took place. The ceasefire between the U.S. and Iran is still officially in place. Now, Dan Kane, of course, from the Joint Chief of Staff, also said this morning that Iran has attacked ships and U.S. forces, but below the threshold of full conflict. Now, the U.S. has over 100 aircraft and thousands of personnel active in the region. More than 1,500 ships remain stuck in the Persian Gulf due to the instability. U.S. forces are escorting ships through the Strait of Hormuz and remain ready for escalation. Iran claims U.S. actions violate the ceasefire, and the administration, of course, led by Hegseth this morning, says that the ceasefire status avoids triggering war powers reporting requirements. Now, this was Hegseth and a reporter interaction this morning.
With the Epoch Times. On Friday, President Trump notified Congress that the hostilities that began on February 28 had terminated. That came on the deadline of the 60-day war powers deadline. Will this administration be seeking congressional approval for any further military operations if the ceasefire breaks down?
Our view is the one you described, that ultimately with the ceasefire the clock stops. If it were to restart, that would be the president's decision. That option is always there, and Iran knows that, and that's why their choices in Project Freedom are important. The president retains the opportunity and the capabilities, more capabilities than we had at the start of this, to restart major combat operations if necessary. If Iran is not willing to follow through on its side of the bargain or make a deal, then the War Department is postured, locked, loaded, and ready to go. We hope it doesn't have to go in that direction, but Admiral Cooper and our forces are in a three-point stance and ready to go. Yeah, last question.
Now, before we discuss this, there's one more piece of audio I want you to hear from this, because Hegseth was also asked by reporters this morning about Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's role in this conflict. Here's what he had to say.
Liam Cosgrove with Zero Hedge. In recent weeks, both Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Israel's head of Mossad have stated their intent not to cease combat with the Iranians. Netanyahu put this on Twitter. Israel's head of Mossad said Israel's goals are not finished until the Iranian government collapses. And so they're referring to the government that President Trump has brokered a ceasefire with and is working on a lasting peace in the region with. And so that's something many Americans, especially American farmers, are hoping he does get to a lasting peace. And so if President Trump is successful in that and the Israelis are explicitly stating their intent to continue fighting at a later date, how can you ensure America doesn't get roped back into a war if that comes? And secondly, with Netanyahu comfortable tweeting something like that out, and also Netanyahu has continued bombing Lebanon despite President Trump explicitly telling
him not to. I would say your question is based on the false premise that somehow President Trump is being pulled in by Prime Minister Netanyahu to any of these actions. And that's where you're going. Just to be clear, President Trump has led at every step of this based on his view of American interest and America first. And we're grateful that Israelis have been very capable partners at many steps of this. And they may have some objectives that times that are slightly different than ours. But there's only one hand on the wheel ultimately directing this, whether it's Project Freedom or previously Operation Epic Fury, and it's President Trump. So we're grateful for their input, their insights, the existential nature of the threat they face from an Iranian bomb, the capabilities that they can bring to that, but ultimately the coordination will happen with the leadership of President Trump. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Okay, before I want to go back to the beginning of this story, when Pete Hegseth talked about the obliteration of Iran's nuclear program, allegedly, back in the summer, and now why we went back in there. Ostensibly, it was because Iran was somehow, after obliterating that, they were close to having a nuclear weapon. Well, now he says it wasn't that they had a nuclear weapon, is that they still had the will to seek a nuclear bomb. So we bombed them over what they were thinking?
That's essentially what he said today.
Okay, that's what I thought. But sometimes I think, well, Brian, you're a little too bottom line simplistic on that.
And again, we reiterate this, and we've repeated it probably ad nauseum for people. Yeah. But this was allowed under the treaty that President Obama brokered. They were allowed to continue to develop their nuclear program under watchful eyes of the UN, of the EU, of the United States. And they were doing that, and they were adhering. And I'm gonna keep repeating this because it is worth repeating. They were adhering to those rules that were set forth in that particular agreement that was made under President Obama. They were allowed to continue development as long as they were allowing people in to see what was actually happening. There was no problem with what Iran was doing under that particular agreement.
The stupidity of that argument, not your argument, but the argument that Pete Hegseth makes, is that you think you can bomb away people's ideas. When you drop bombs on somebody, you don't change their minds. What you do is either more ingrain those ideas in their heads or take those ideas and amplify them in a negative way against you. You can bomb Iran from now until there's nothing left. The people who remain are still going to want to get that nuclear program. They're going to hate America even more than they ever did. The threat is greater and greater. If we had stuck with the old deal, we would be monitoring this. And yes, you could say, do you trust the Iranians? No, but I trust the inspectors that are going in there. I trust everything around that deal. So this is just, it's such flawed logic. And the more you listen to Pete Hegseth, the more you have to start believing that he is not only inept and underqualified for this job, but is cosplaying this whole thing of warfighter and the Department of War and locked and loaded and we're in a three-point stance. And Stop with the theatrics, because we can see right through it. And we know what the facts are.
And it also bothers me that obviously we know that truth is hard for this administration to come by, and they like to change the shiny object that America is focused on. But today I felt like we got a little bit more glimpse of the actual truth behind all of this. And I don't know if that was purposeful. I don't know if that was by accident or just Pete Hegseth getting the wrong question that rattled him a little bit. I have no idea. I'm not going to speculate on that. But I feel like we got a little bit more truth as to how this entire situation started. And the fact that he actually had to come out and say, Benjamin Netanyahu did not bait this president. Are we sure about that? Because you're pretty adamant on that. You're pretty adamant, and that's not actually what the reporter asked you, but you're going to make sure that you defend that argument. So,
well, we've seen everybody from this administration, when they go in front of a Senate or congressional committee, they have a list of talking points and targets. That talking point now, and again, this is a theory, but based on what you said, it makes perfect sense that they would want to make sure, as things are going down, that You want to portray Donald Trump as the strong decision maker. Despite reports that Netanyahu has asked four or five past presidents to do this thing, and they all said no.
Right.
They all refused to join them in bombing Iran. He found a guy who is susceptible to praise, who wants to be seen as a tough guy, who wants to be seen as a military leader and a strong man. So you have to have your people out there saying, he was in control, he was in control, he was in control. It's just another talking point in their agenda of BS that they throw at us every day.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there is some other stuff.
There is.
I think. But did you have more on this stuff?
Nope. No, I think that's I think that's all we need to hear for today, right?
We've had enough of this stuff from Pete
Hegseth today.
Well, what if I told you that Sun Prairie was considering a plan to reduce the number of polling places? Would that make you happy? Sun Prairie officials are considering cutting the number of polling places in the Madison suburb by half. Under an ordinance to be introduced tonight at the city council meeting, the city of about 39,000 would have one polling site per each of its four council districts instead of the current two as of August for the gubernatorial primary. Sun Prairie expanded to have eight polling places in late 2019. All of those were only used for one election, February 2020, for the spring primary. Then COVID hit, of course, and the city consolidated into one big polling place for the April, August, and November elections of 2020. Then it went to four polling places for the elections in 2021 and returned to eight in 2022. Following all those numbers? Maybe not. But just know they now have eight, two per district. Lessening the need for eight polls is increasing popularity because of absentee voting, so that kind of makes sense. The city does estimate that they would save about $4,000 to $5,000 in personnel costs per election, or about $30,000 over the two-year cycle. They'll save some more on equipment, but the city council is saying that it is not a cost-cutting measure. They will vote on the plan tonight. They'll hear the arguments tonight and vote on it during the meeting on May 19th. So this is different than the gerrymandering. This is just saying, okay, you're still going to have one in each council district. So everybody still gets to vote. Now it's just, we don't need as many. So I don't have an issue with this. And if the numbers are bearing out that a lot of people in Sun Prairie are voting absentee, then, okay, why have all these places open instead of – why duplicate your efforts in each district?
See, and to me it feels a little short-sighted for a long-term problem, because we are trying to make voting easier and more accessible for everyone, and absentee voting, the political rhetoric around it has increased. We know that this particular GOP has tried to eliminate mail-in voting, and I understand that they need to save money, but I'm also in the mindset of, okay, if that's the route that particularly goes, are you going to end up having to make all these polling places again because people are going to need a place to vote? Stay engaged. If you're in Sun Prairie and this really bothers you, show up, speak up, plan ahead, stay engaged beyond this decision, make your points heard.
Are there places you wish cell phones were banned? We will get into that and a kind of surprising study about that. We'll talk about it all. This is Daybreak. I'm Brian Noonan on the Civic Media Network. She's Jamie Martinson. She's got a giant pink water.
Fairly solid and better than expected. It's Daybreak with Brian and Jamie.
Good morning. Thank you so much for joining us. It is 22 minutes after 8 o'clock. A much cooler day than yesterday, but a lot of sunshine across the state. I can get down with that. We always need a little sunshine. My name is Jamie Martinson.
Hey, good morning. I'm Brian Noonan. We are in a three-point stance and ready to go. 855-75-CIVIC, 855-752-4842. Are there places you wish cell phones were banned? Now, this actually surprised me, the results of this, because, as you know, there's been a big debate over the last few years about schools banning cell phones in class. And you couldn't bring them into the classroom, and parents were, oh, but what if my kid is, you know, unsafe? So schools have been trying to find different ways of doing it, different ways of keeping cell phones out of the classroom. And the conventional thinking was that if you don't have cell phones, your test scores are going to go up, your mental health is going to be better as a student, and your kids are going to pay more attention in class. Well, that's not necessarily the case. Cell phone bans have reduced unauthorized usage in schools. There has been almost no academic benefit to this. Test scores have not gone up. The change is about effectively close to zero based on what researchers have said. This came out of the University of Pennsylvania, Duke University, and the University of Michigan. Just a step above community colleges,
yeah,
those three.
They're kind of okay at things, yes.
Yeah, I guess. If you're as a safety school, yeah. Maybe. but anyway, now teachers are loving it,
mm-hmm.
which makes sense. Teachers are saying, yes, it's good. There's less distractions, this or that. But in reality, it's not really good. I still say there has to be a way to make that compromise of keeping parents at bay with their concerns about safety, because while the worst case scenario, which is what we always go to when we're trying to make an argument,
mm-hmm.
the worst case scenario is, what if there's a school shooter right. and my kid is sheltering in their classroom and they have to call me? Okay, that's the worst case.
Right.
So if you want to operate on the worst case scenario, then we have to figure out a way to maybe when the kids come in the classroom, the phones are just put in a basket.
I was just going to say, I have a really good friend who is a high school teacher. She teaches history, civics in her respective smaller school. That is her rule when they come into their room. They're allowed to keep their phones with them. They must be put away somewhere, whether that is a pocket, whether that is the pouch of a backpack. She doesn't care. If they are caught with their phone, they are automatically given a 5-point pop quiz that she always has prepared at the ready. And
rocks.
And she's like, yeah. I haven't had one problem with the cell phone in my classroom since. But if they do need them, they have them. And she's like, because they don't have a ban in their
sure.
school, in their
okay.
state.
Okay.
So she can't actually ban them, but she's like, I don't need them distracted. And she's a very interactive teacher. They do a lot of really fun things in her classroom. And that is her rule, that if you pull out your phone in my class, then you will get a 5-point pop quiz. And
I like that.
And that's,
I would like you know, those shoe kind of things
sure.
that you put in your closet,
yep.
put the shoes in. You could do one, and when the kids come in, they put their phone, every
yep.
seat is numbered.
Yep.
In our school district, every kid had, seats were numbered,
yep.
or kids had a number, and you drop your phone in there, and if, oh, number 14, do you have a phone? Yeah.
Yeah.
Put it on the wall. And then they get up and they leave. So they're in the room, they can watch, nobody's messing with them. It's behind the teacher's desk.
Yep.
If teachers even have a desk anymore, a lot don't.
If she has a test in her class, then she has a basket that they all go into.
Yeah.
So that there's no, and nobody wants to try to cheat, use Google to look up the answer. Now, mm-hmm. You were mentioning some of the state bans. Here in Wisconsin, starting in the 2026-2027 school year, schools across the state will be required to limit cell phone use during instructional time. That was under Act 42. A lot of districts are already doing this, but it's now a statewide policy with discussion about expanding to full bell-to-bell bans. And this, I believe, is a law. Somebody can correct me if I'm wrong, and I'll have to look it up. But I believe this is something that Governor Evers just signed in this last legislative period. So that's how they've done things and are doing things in Wisconsin. Again, some school districts already had a ban, but now this will go be in effect for next school year across
the
board.
Well, that bell-to-bell ban is happening already in about 5,000 districts across the country where
yeah.
kids have to come in. You put them in a zip bag
mm-hmm.
like you're at a Dave Chappelle show and you get it out when the bell rings. And I can understand a parent's worry.
Yeah.
But I also know, and this may be naive, that 99% of your kids are not going to be, thank God, involved in a school
right.
shooting. So we have to prepare for the worst, but at the least amount. And the good news is it's not changing test scores. So if your school is doing very poorly, don't blame it on the test scores. Blame it on the administration, the district, the curriculum, maybe your kid.
Your student just not studying.
Maybe the kid's not the brightest, you know, ixnay on the day.
One of the things that I found most interesting when I've talked to friends who are teachers, and if they have a ban or they do something like my other friend where they have to put it away or the pop quiz, one of the things they talk about is in their schools, the online bullying has actually decreased when they do have no cell phone use.
That
in
makes
school.
Perfect sense.
Because we know that kids, well, anybody can be cruel. Adults can be pretty darn cruel too.
Kids are really mean, though. Kids are really mean.
And people think they're keyboard warriors, right? You can say anything behind a keyboard because you have that protection. And that's another thing my friends who are teachers have talked about is the amount of online bullying has decreased in their schools.
Good.
When they do have the phone ban. So I thought that was an interesting aspect of it.
Yeah, we can't blame kids for having beer muscles because they're not drinking at school, as far as we know.
Nope.
All right, when we come back, you know the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act, but how is it going to affect Wisconsin? We'll get to that and so much more. This is Daybreak on the Civic Media Network.
Local voices, statewide impact. It's Daybreak with Brian and Jamie.
It's 8:35 right now. Hopefully you are having a great start to your Tuesday. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Civic Media Network. My name is Jamie Martinson.
And good morning. I'm Brian Noonan. If you want to weigh in, 855-75-CIVIC, 855-752-4842. We talk about this a lot, gerrymandering on this program. One, because it's one of Jamie's biggest pet peeves.
Such
and two,
a
because
problem in politics, though.
it is. And there's that's no shade on it being one of your biggest pet peeves. It is. And to be honest, unless you followed Wisconsin politics for years and years, you may not be that familiar with gerrymandering. And now you're hearing about it all the time. And you're like, where did this come from? Well, it's been around a long time. And, you know, we had the Voting Rights Act come along, and that was supposed to stop some of this, and it really didn't. And then last week, we know the Supreme Court kind of gutted that because Louisiana was upset that they had redrawn a map that actually gave one-third of Wisconsin citizens two seats in the House of Representatives.
Yeah.
That doesn't seem too bad. But anyway, they did that. So it's been a lot of discussion about how that is going to affect the midterms, how it's going to affect the general election. And now we want to talk a little bit about more how it's going to affect Wisconsin. Because, to be honest, in the short term, not too much. Right? We're not going to see too much in the short term, which is good. The primary, the midterms are going to go off as possible. We know we're in the middle of another map debate here where the governor wants to make sure that the maps are permanent. He wants that done. The Republicans came into the special session, did absolutely nothing, so that debate gets kicked down the road a little bit. But when it comes to the midterms, we're not really going to see too much.
Right, because our maps, the current maps that Wisconsin is using as far as how the lines have been drawn and the districts look, are good through the end of this year. I believe most likely what's happening, my theory on this is that the Republicans do not want that special session because they are hedging their bets that Tom Tiffany could be governor. If Tom Tiffany is governor, they definitely don't want to be using democratically or more fair maps, right? And that's not what Tom Tiffany is going to want to do as governor of the state, because obviously he is more in the camp of our maps are fine, we don't need to redraw these. And they could go back to the way they were. So with that being said, I'm going to assume that that is why the Republicans, and by the way, 14 of them now have stepped out of our state House and Senate combined. I believe that is probably why. They can tell you that there wasn't enough information. They needed Tony Evers to clarify some things. I believe it's why that I believe they're hedging their bets till the end of 2026.
Well, and at the basis of this argument, this Louisiana case, it did come down to race and drawing maps based on race. Now, Alito, in his upholding of this case and in his decision, said that he really nitpicked the law, and he said it's not about race or partisanship. It's about you have to prove that the state intentionally redrew these lines based on race. Now, it all hangs on that word intentionally. And can you prove intent? Well, to the naked eye, to people with even the slightest bit of critical thinking, especially in the Louisiana case, you could see that it came down to race.
Where they eliminated representation completely for districts of color? Yes.
Well,
yes.
Is that the intent, or is that just part of, that's just the way the lines came out, Jamie? That's the BS argument from
Right.
Alito.
Right.
And it's very clear. Now, you may have heard of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, very conservative group here in Wisconsin. They're saying that they're already looking at where lines can be changed and drawn in the Wisconsin maps, and they say that some of them were drawn explicitly for racial reasons, and so those are the ones they're going to go after, especially the ones around Milwaukee.
You mean, again, making sure that all constituents have fair representation? I mean, this is the thing. This entire debate, and we've talked about this entire debate mm-hmm. about gerrymandering and drawing lines is to basically make sure that certain districts, usually minority districts and urban districts, have as little representation as absolutely possible, because we wouldn't possibly want those districts to have a say in what happens to government or in government, because they're a minority district. They're in a city. They couldn't possibly know what's good for them. I mean, is that the argument that we're essentially going with? Because they tell me that's not what it is. But from the naked eye, it feels like that.
But in Wisconsin, other than around urban areas, most of the redistricting battle has been on partisan lines. Does that partisan battle then happen to bleed over in some districts into a racial aspect? Of course it does. But primarily it's Republican versus Democrat, because we've seen Wisconsin's balance of power shift so often that it's not so much, well, we're disenfranchising black voters or brown voters. They want to disenfranchise Democratic
voters.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. If you don't agree with us, we don't want you to vote. So it's a little different. I believe it's a lot different than the Louisiana case.
Sure.
Our circumstances here, but the result can still be the same.
Yeah. I think that's, as we look at this going forward, and when you're looking at the fact that, you know, these groups now want to redraw lines for, say, Milwaukee. I mean, there are boundaries for the Milwaukee City Council districts and certain school districts that they essentially want to do away with. And as we're referring to, race is a very common factor in drawing the Milwaukee City Council districts.
Yes.
You know, even though there are campaigns that will add additional majority-minority districts, and those haven't always succeeded, though. And I think this is where this particular argument bothers me, because we're not only looking at it from a national election, but now we're letting this whole Voting Rights Act and the upheaval with the Supreme Court bleed into our local elections. And those local elections and state elections are really what are most important in our everyday lives. Now, you can say that this presidential administration is awful, and sure, believe that. But at the same time, look at what happens on the daily level. I mean, from your city council meetings to your schools to your property taxes, your local representation, your water bills, all of that happens on the local level. So the fact that we're letting that now bleed into the national decision, bleed into our local elections, I think this is where a lot of people should be paying more attention than maybe they have in the past.
Yeah, because it is important. And we talked, I mentioned that it was mostly partisan in mm-hmm. Wisconsin as opposed to race. But there are 9 legislative districts that are minority majorities, and those will be at risk. And so on that level, it is it does come down to race. Again, it can be couched as, well, it's not really about race, but it is, and it's about, we keep saying it, the word disenfranchised is the way to go. And this should bother you on a local level, as Jamie said. It should bother you on a state level, and it should bother you on a national level. That, and this is one of those things. Earlier we were talking about, okay, if the Democrats get back in control of the House and the Senate in November, instead of wasting all their time or committing all their time to accountability for the administration's wrongdoings, they need to get things straight. And this right. is one of them. It was one of the things we pointed out. They need to get back in there, get this gerrymandering bill passed, and make sure this can stop happening. Then you're not going to have the constant debate here in Wisconsin about the maps. I know the governor's trying to do that, but if it was at a federal level, there would be no question. And no matter who was in power down the line here in Wisconsin, they couldn't change it. Let's let the people vote and the chips fall where they may. If you're that worried about people voting, maybe you need to look inside at your platform, what your party stands for, who you back, and how you treat the people that you purport to want to represent. So there's a lot more than, you can't fix it by just redrawing the lines. You're fixing it in the short term because maybe you'll win. But as we talked about before, maybe this will be a backlash and people will finally see this for what it is, a very ham-handed attempt at cheating and rigging an election.
And I think that's the important part, because I've seen a lot of woe is me since the Supreme Court decision on social media and things like that. Here's the thing. I get that they're trying to make it harder. I get that people don't want you to vote. They do want people to be disenfranchised. But that's where if you're somebody who cares, you need to dig in even more. That's where you have to become even more proactive. And you literally have to pay attention to what's happening locally. Because let's be honest, elections here in this state are sometimes decided by the most razor-thin margins. Even small changes in a district line can shift the outcome. And that's at a national, local, state level, whatever election you're talking about. That's your school board election, that those margins can be very, very thin. So if you're worried about this, pay attention locally, because those changes are most likely to show up in your city council, your school board maps. And those are the meetings that don't always get the headlines, right? But those, again, are the meetings that are going to matter most to your everyday life. You should also be willing to show up and attend your local meetings, the public hearings, submit comments when maps are proposed or challenged. Talk to local officials and talk to people who you can actually get a meeting with, right? Because you can do that with your Alder folks and things like that in your cities, right?
Ron Johnson not going to take your calls.
No, in fact, his voicemail might still be full. And you should also vote in those local elections, because I know it's really easy, especially in this state, to be able to tune out how many elections we have. But turnout in the local elections is often low, and that means a small number of voters are deciding outcomes for all of us. So make sure you're voting, and also stay informed. Know your district. If lines change, understand how that affects your representation and who is running. And then finally, hold your local leaders accountable. Ask the questions. Why were those lines drawn a certain way? Why did they vote this way? Why did they say that they wouldn't at the local meeting, and then all of a sudden their vote changed? Who benefits and who might be left out? As a citizen, not only of your town, your county, your state, you're allowed to ask those questions. And I know that we've gotten into this weird quagmire where it doesn't feel like we're supposed to, but these people still work for us when they're elected. You're still their boss.
I disagree with the we feel like we're not supposed to ask. I feel now we're more empowered to ask and we're more energized to ask, because when things are going smoothly, you don't have to get involved. You just go, okay, or you don't hear about things. It's, which is no excuse not to get involved just because they're not talking to you. But now we're bombarded every day with issues, from our school boards trying to ban curriculums to the federal government doing God only knows what today is going to bring. So we are all empowered, I think, now to ask more questions and to come at people harder and to go to town halls and try to and push these people for answers,
and I would
which
even,
is what we should do all the time.
And I would even encourage you to run in your local district. If you're worried about your kids' school, if you're worried about your own taxes, if you're no one in your community, even if you're not, but you've got something to say, run. Put your name into the hat. Try to make a difference.
Why not? Why are we so connected to stories about animals? We have another one coming up, and we'll get to it here on Daybreak on the Civic Media Network.
From Lake Superior to Lake Michigan, this is Wisconsin's Morning Conversation. Daybreak with Brian and Jamie.
It's 8:52 right now. We hope that you are having a great morning. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Civic Media Network. Are we already at the last segment? Is that where we're at? Wow.
TikTok, right. Time to go.
It's gone fast.
Yes, it did go fast today, which is good. If it went fast for us, then it went quickly for the listeners as well.
And they're like, thank God, they're about ready to leave.
Oh, I don't know. What are they going to listen to for the next 22 hour, 21 hours?
Stephanie Miller, she's on next.
All right, listen, I'm a big fan of just waiting for us to come back. Go listen to, just turn off the radio, listen to some of our podcasts on Spotify.
There you go.
Maybe go to one of our social media pages. Maybe go to my personal page.
Yes.
Brian Noonan on Facebook. And if you will indulge me for just 1 second, I host a podcast called Crafty Brewers Tales Behind Craft Beer. We share stories of brewers. We don't just talk about beer. We don't rate beer. We find what's interesting about the brewers and their process, and we share these stories. We've done Wisconsin breweries. We've done over 65 breweries. Last year, we won an award for the best video podcast. My partner works really hard. We're very proud of this podcast and the stories that we get to share with everybody. And so we are nominated again. We're semifinalists for Best Video Podcast again this year for the Quill Podcast Awards. And you can go and vote for us. Doesn't cost anything. It doesn't take much time. If you go to my page on Instagram or Facebook, you'll see the post. You'll see the link. If you want to vote for us, that would be great. I'd really appreciate it. There's enough of the so Brian Noonan on Facebook or Instagram. And and if you like beer, or even if you like great stories, because interestingly enough, our metrics show that a lot of the people who listen to and view our show are not beer drinkers. They just like the stories. So if you want to hear about a nuclear engineer who became a brewer, or a priest that became a brewer,
that's awesome.
Or a guy who at 22 or 21 won a coveted sommelier award, youngest to do it. These are the kind of stories we share.
Very cool.
All right. Now, you might connect with those stories. Maybe you won't. But everybody seems to connect with an animal story. A story about an animal seems to get us all, even the most crusty amongst us, myself included. Here's a story about an animal, and we go, oh. Why do you think that is? 855-75-CIVIC, 855-752-4842. And it rears its head again because, Jamie, you wanted to share the story of Timmy the stranded whale.
I
went, oh,
right?
Okay.
It's like we're like the Grinch when we hear an animal story, right? Our hearts grow.
That's right.
But Timmy is actually a humpback whale that has made headlines globally since he became stranded in shallow waters for several weeks, and then he was released into the North Sea on Saturday. He is a 40-foot-long internet phenomenon now, and he has been wallowing in shallow waters near Germany since March. Saturday's daring rescue mission was the fifth staged attempt to get Timmy back into deeper waters. 5 times they've tried this. So
what if Timmy was afraid of deep water?
I don't know, but these rescuers were not worrying about that.
They didn't ask Timmy.
They did ask Timmy.
You're getting back in the deep water. We know what's best for you, Timmy.
Now, this is according to an article in the New York Times. They report that the rescue was funded by two German millionaires who commissioned a massive water-filled barge to transport Timmy to freedom. There's this footage, and if you have the time to do a Google search for Timmy the whale, please do so, because there's this footage out there of Timmy's release, and it shows him puffing spurts of water from his blowhole as he makes his way back into the waters. There's comments.
I can't swim.
There's comments under the post that were filled with a lot of well wishes from fans, because obviously Timmy's reading those, who sent the whale hope for a long and healthy life. But some experts warned that Timmy's health had been compromised to the point that a return to the open waters might actually delay the inevitable for Timmy and just kind of prolong his suffering at the same time. In fact, the International Whaling Commission repeatedly criticized efforts to move Timmy from the shallow waters where he was found, and they argued that the interventions, although well-meant, impose very considerable additional stress upon a creature that is already gravely ill to little ultimate benefit. Now, after Saturday's successful release, the IWC said that it could acknowledge the considerable technical, logistical, and financial effort that this rescue required. They did warn that it was not necessarily, though, going to be a fairy tale ending for Timmy's story.
All right, Buzzkill Jones.
Well,
cut it out.
I know. I mean, we like to see. Here's the thing. When you see an animal, right, it literally, when they're in these situations, do you think part of the allure we have for these animals is that it does require the best of humankind? Because I think we will do more for animals than we will for one another in a
lot 100%.
Of cases, right?
100%. I would run into a burning building and rescue one of my dogs. Some people, I might let char a little bit. I'll probably get them. I'll probably get them out, but they're going to be a little crusty. Yeah, you got to wait a minute. I need a drink of water. I just rescued the dogs. I got to take a drink, get my breath, then I'll come in. You relax.
Yeah.
So I will. But yes, you're right. Because unless you are truly a heartless, soulless garbage person, you can't see an animal suffer and not want to help them. Whether they're a dog or a cat, which we love, or something else. You know, I told you about the squirrel, the baby squirrel that had the broken leg, and I spent 2 hours on the phone trying to find somebody to come and get it. And they're like, we're not coming to rescue a squirrel. And I was like, they were like, well, why don't you take it? I'm like, listen, my dedication only goes so far. I don't want to see this squirrel hurt, but I'm not nursing a baby squirrel back to health.
I also have a dog who has like dog instincts when in certain situations. Now, I love my girl. She is a true huntress, though, when she needs to be, because she's part terrier. And there are times that she does these things, and then she looks at me with like a half dog smile on her face, and I'm like, who are you, Cujo? What just happened here? Because she's very efficient.
Remember?
She's very efficient at killing. So there would be that aspect for me.
So if you had a baby squirrel in a box, she'd be thinking, ooh, they brought me something from Chipotle.
Yes.
This is going to be great.
Yes.
I cannot wait. Well, that's it. We're done. Tuesday's over. But we will be back tomorrow. Thank you for listening and being part of the show. I'm Brian Noonan. This is Daybreak.
I'm Jamie Martinson, 859. Thank you for another great day. This is the Civic Media Network.